It's Thursday, April 16, 2015. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Tuesday's edition of The Wall Street Journal featured the headline that reads, "Mideast Christians Trapped by Extremists." The article's by Sam Dogger, and he points to the reality that what's happening now in the Middle East is nothing less than the extermination of the Christian populations in the Muslim-dominated world. This is something that is now so well attested by international and national media that it finds its way into a news story on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Dogger writes in the beginning of his article from Lebanon, quote, "Three decades ago, plainclothes Syrian agents went door to door in this border village seeking out young Christian men who were abducted and killed in a notorious chapter of Lebanon's 15-year civil war," end quote. So Dogger's pointing to more than 30 years ago in order to say that for many Christians in these parts of the world, it is horrifyingly back to the future. But the future and the present are even more horrifying than the past, because missing from the equation in so much of the Middle East is stability, political stability, that though often at the hands of secular autocrats, offered some real protection to Christian communities. That protection is now largely taken away. A chart published on the front page of the paper demonstrates the percentage of Lebanon's population that is Christian, dropping in the year 1900 at 80% down to 34.2% in the year 2015. And as the article makes clear, that percentage is now set to plummet as all protections over these Christian populations have largely been removed. Inside the paper, in a chart published in the continuation of the article, the persecution and elimination of Christian minority populations is made clear in nations ranging from Lebanon and Qatar, Jordan and Syria and Egypt, to Sudan, Bahrain, even Turkey, Tunisia, Iran, following all the way down to Oman and Kuwait. It is a very difficult picture for Christians in the Muslim-dominated world. Now, those operating out of a biblical worldview should be noting very carefully, again, how much theology matters. Islam holds to a theology in terms of how it's lived out on the ground that is openly hostile to minority Christian populations. Now, according to Muhammad and to the larger Muslim tradition, there is the possibility for Muslims and non-Muslims to live in peace in Muslim-dominated countries. But that is under the Muslim teaching of what is called dhimmitude, which means the acknowledged minority status without rights of Jewish and Christian populations in Muslim-dominated lands. But what we have seen in recent decades, especially now in the chaos of the Middle East and the Muslim-dominated world, is that even the Muslim idea of dhimmitude, largely reduced to minority status with no rights for Christians and Jews, has given way to open calls to exterminate and eliminate the Christian populations. Theologically, these Christian populations include Maronite Catholics, they include Orthodox Christians of both Syrian and Greek backgrounds, not to mention Egyptian, and of course the Coptic Church in Egypt as well. Every one of these Middle Eastern variants holds to a different theology. In most cases, those individual theologies, whether Maronite Catholics, Orthodox Christians, or Copts, would be very different from the understanding of the gospel and of the main truths of the Christian faith as held by evangelical Christians. But in terms of a headline like this, our first understanding should be this. Here we have those who are claiming the name of Christ who are being eliminated and exterminated from the face of the earth in much of the Muslim-dominated world. Muslims are not, in this case, making theological distinctions as evangelical Christians rightly would want to do. They are making distinctions over whether or not an individual, a village, or a group claims allegiance to the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. In that sense, we should understand that when Christians, by any one of these variants in the Middle East, are being identified as Christians, it is because of their allegiance to the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. And that makes every one of these stories and every one of these groups important to evangelical Christians. For we understand the lesson that we are seeing here. The lesson that radical Islam on the ground leads to the extermination of Christian populations. Understanding that the Muslim idea of dhimmitude, of forced Christian subservience, eventually gives way to this elimination of Christian communities altogether. We also come face to face with the fact that what is the bottom line issue here is allegiance to the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, the willingness to be called a Christian. In much of the world today, that is as much a matter of life and death as it was in the first century. We are witnessing a new era of Christian martyrdom, right at our own times and largely right before our own eyes. We dare not claim the name of Christ and fail to understand the price that is being paid by many others who claim that name in very different parts of the world. Next, shifting to the United States, one of our persistent and urgent concerns is the nature and identity of marriage and the fate of marriage in late modernity, in the late modern age. Now, Carol Costello, an anchor with CNN, writes an article published at CNN entitled, Ready for the Marriage Apocalypse? Now, that's interesting just in terms of a headline. Here you have a secular news source and a secular news anchor talking about marriage joined with the word apocalypse, a word that is mostly associated with Christian eschatology, not with secular analysis. But it's clear that in this headline, Carol Costello is telling us that marriage, in terms of even a secular analysis, is just about to disappear, certainly as the expectation of most Americans. Costello writes, and I quote, "The marriage apocalypse may be coming. Talk to any millennial and you can envision an America virtually marriage-free with everyone happily single." She says about herself, "I did and I do." Going on, she says, "Recently I talked about marriage with a group of journalism students from my alma mater, Kent State University. They came to me," she says, "for career advice, which I gave them. But I also picked their brains about politics, religion, and marriage. Their views on marriage intrigued me the most, cause guess what? They don't care what your generation thinks. They'll get married if and when they want." She quotes a young woman named Jackie who says that she really wants to go to Europe rather than to get married. She said, quote, "I'm really looking for a travel buddy, and I don't think you need a wedding ring to prove that you love someone. I see a lot of people," said this student at Kent State, "get married too soon or stay together and are unhappy because they're afraid to be alone. And I would rather be alone, successful and happy, than in a relationship where I'm not happy. I'm okay being single forever as long as I'm happy," end quote. Now, here we have a central issue to the Christian worldview. How does any individual become happy? What we face in terms of our modern cultural revolution is the demand by many people that law, custom, even the definition of marriage has to change in order that they will be happy. Well, let's just step back for a moment and recognize that one of the fundamental issues of the Christian worldview is that we are not promised happiness. Another fundamental assumption of the Christian worldview is this: we really don't even know what would make us happy. We've all had the experience of thinking we know what will make us happy, only to have what we demanded and find out that it doesn't make us happy. It's very easy for us to think we know even in the present what will make us happy, but we turn out to be incompetent at that, much less over a lifespan when our own understandings of happiness will often change and change over and over again. One of the fundamental understandings of the Christian worldview is that left to our own devices, we will not make ourselves happy. We don't even know how to make ourselves happy. That's why the Christian biblical worldview is established upon the understanding that our Creator knows us better than we know ourselves and has created for us the institutions and the habits of mind and the laws of living that will actually lead to greater human happiness. So let's think about that for a moment. If it is God's good gift, given in creation itself, a gift that God himself declared to be good, then the enjoyment and receiving of marriage, as the Creator establishes it, is what's going to lead to greater human flourishing and greater human happiness. Now, human happiness, that's a word we have to use with some hesitation anyway, because happiness is largely a state of emotional being. And as we know ourselves, our emotions ebb and flow. They are in a process of constant flux. That's why when we think about happiness, we have to understand that we have to lean into faithfulness, knowing that happiness, true enduring happiness, will come to us as a result of faithfulness. It doesn't work the other way around. What Carol Costello is writing about in this article is that increasing numbers of Americans, a frightening percentage of Americans, no longer think of marriage as essential to their own happiness. She talks about these journalism students she met at Kent State University, but then she generalizes it to the country when she writes about the coming marriage apocalypse. She says, quote, "In light of a fascinating Pew Research report on marriage, when asked if society is just as well off if people have priorities other than marriage, 50% of respondents said yes. Furthermore, 66% of that 50% who said yes are identified as adults between the ages of 18 and 29. In other words, the people you would expect to be either married or moving into marriage, but they're not. As Costello acknowledges, this is alarming people across the political and ideological spectrum. As she writes, and I quote, Religious leaders are deeply concerned for moral reasons. Economists are concerned for our collective future. Studies, she says, show that marriage is correlated with economic well-being, though it is not clear whether the causality arrow goes from marriage toward the economic benefit or in the other direction. End quote. Well, economic studies may not show the direction of that fulfillment, but the Bible certainly does. Note again that what she says here is that even economists are concerned for the fact that marriage is correlated with economic well-being. Now, the background presumption to that analysis is that, at least for most Americans, economic well-being is at least in some way related to happiness. So what Carol Costello is documenting here is that increasing percentages of America, a frightening percentage of Americans, no longer are moving towards the institution that even economists note is fundamental to economic well-being, and thus we might think to what even most Americans would define as their own personal happiness. In terms of the future, Costello says you can look to Scandinavia. She cites USA Today, quote, "In Norway, 82% of couples have their first child out of wedlock. The numbers are similarly high for Sweden and Denmark. While many couples marry after having their first or second child," she goes on to say, "it's clear marriage in parts of Scandinavia is dying." Now, as we look at that, we recognize that there are many, in terms of the American political class, who continue to look specifically to Scandinavia as the example they believe America should follow. So what we're looking at in terms of the great cultural divide in America is a divide that often comes fundamentally down to the institution of marriage. That's why marriage, whether it's understood as same-sex marriage or marriage in terms of the more general cultural conversation, that's why marriage keeps coming up on the headlines over and over again. Even those on the political left, from Andrew Cherlin and Isabel Sawhill, right down to Robert Putnam, who's written a new book as a professor at Harvard University, there is ample evidence of all of the documentation that comes in terms of the pathologies that inevitably follow the eclipse, the marginalization, the subversion, and the breakdown of marriage. So here you have an anchor for CNN writing a piece on the coming marriage apocalypse, asking if we're ready. Well, this is where Christians respond and say, in terms of the larger culture, there's no way to get ready. One of the persistent issues we need to remember is that when marriage breaks down, marriage as the union of a man and a woman that is a lasting, exclusive covenant relationship, when you have the breakdown of marriage as the expectation of having a father and a mother in the home, there is no government, there is no society that can fill the gap that is left where marriage and a mother and father belong. By the way, that is amply affirmed now in the very nations that Carol Costello points to as the potential for our future, that is the nations of Scandinavia. The Scandinavian states have extraordinarily high rates of taxation and extraordinarily generous welfare systems, but they have declining populations and their economies now cannot perpetuate the welfare state that they have put into place. Furthermore, we're also looking at the fact that the breakdown of marriage, the eclipse of marriage in terms of the cultural horizon, has meant that the moral transformation in those societies has gone, as we understand it must go, far beyond childbearing, far beyond sex and reproduction, far beyond marriage, to a total reorientation of the societies themselves. Now, while we're looking at Scandinavia, let's also remember this. Those were among the earliest nations to follow the trajectory of secularization. Those were among the first nations to show exceedingly high rates of secular worldviews. It's not an accident. We as Christians understand that. In that sense, when we look, as Carol Costello invites us to look, at Scandinavia as the future, we see an American future that not only leads to the further breakdown of marriage, but more fundamentally points to the more pervasive secularization of our culture. As we see over and over again, those two things tend almost always to go together. But we also need to know this. It's the secularization generally that comes first. It is the moral patterns of behavior that come second. But in an individual perspective, that's not always the way it happens. Because one of the most interesting biblical insights is this. Sometimes when we change our moral behavior, we then, subsequent to that, change our theology in order to be at peace with ourselves and our new pattern of moral behavior. Now, I think we can be assured that that's not what Carol Costello had in mind when she wrote this headline news story. But for Christians reading the story, that had better be what we have in mind. Next, in terms of the moral revolution, the issue of marijuana comes up again and again, because while we are noting the great moral change around us, one of the most noticeable is the shifting American understanding of the morality of marijuana. And once again, it's USA Today that leads the nation in reporting on this moral change. Tuesday's edition of USA Today included an article with this headline, "Pot Industry Wary of Big Tobacco." Trevor Hughes is the reporter for USA Today, and this is one of those stories that becomes a parable right before our eyes. He writes this, "While federal law makes their entire industry illegal, many marijuana store owners, growers, and retailers fear something completely different, big tobacco." Now, we've been talking about this coming, and people in California and Colorado have especially seen it coming, and that is the fact that when this great moral change takes place on marijuana, and if and when marijuana is fully legalized, it's not going to be the industry that so many people think it is and will be. It's not going to be a little industry of 60s radicals grown up to be tobacco growers and their younger acolytes. It's going to be big American corporate interests. It's going to be a big corporate future. This is irritating the marijuana growers who are right now, along with retailers and others, arguing for the legalization of marijuana, as we've seen in some states, quite successfully. Hughes then writes, and I quote, "Today, most legal recreational marijuana operations are small, limited to a single state, and barred from ever getting large by regulators who want to keep a close eye on the fast-growing industry. But those small operators," he says, "struggle to get bank loans for expansion, often produce an inconsistent product, and sometimes have no idea how to balance supply and demand for their crops." And Hughes says, "Now many fear that tobacco companies, with their deep pockets, long-standing experience dealing with heavy government regulation, and relationships with farmers and generations of farmers, will jump into the burgeoning marijuana market. At marijuana business conventions and in private conversations," he says, "it sometimes seems as if everyone has heard a rumor about big tobacco getting in," end quote. I said this is a parable right before our eyes. Here's the bottom line of the parable. It turns out that a small sinful business won't stay a small sinful business. Eventually, big business comes in. What we have right now on the part of many in America is a rather romanticized understanding of the marijuana industry, not to mention marijuana itself. As I said, USA Today has really led the nation in coverage over the issue of marijuana, pointing out, as we discussed on the briefing some weeks ago, that there isn't even any consistent health regulation when it comes to the sale of marijuana. As a matter of fact, most of the marijuana legally sold in the states where marijuana can legally be sold is fundamentally unregulated, even in terms not only of its quality and potency, but also just in terms of the fact that it's often mixed with chemical agents or even with infectious disease. We've also talked about the fact that inevitably children and minors become involved to the point that now not only are there more marijuana distributorships in a state like Colorado than there are Starbucks and McDonald's combined, but it's now the case, acknowledged even by Colorado political authorities, that when a teenager in Colorado has a first cigarette, it's not likely to be tobacco. It's far more likely to be marijuana. For a very long time, that romanticized marijuana industry has feared mostly government agents, police, and especially the federal government. But now they fear big tobacco, which is to say the big tobacco companies. And as Trevor Hughes makes clear, they've actually got good reason to be concerned because, as he indicates, since at least the 1970s, tobacco companies have been interested in marijuana and marijuana legalization. As Hughes also writes, this past summer, researchers poring through more than 80 million pages of previously secret tobacco industry documents found that Big Tobacco has long had an interest in pot. As I said, this article is a parable in and of itself, and as Hughes writes, quote, "The idea of big marijuana runs contrary to the counterculture attitude of many marijuana industry insiders, especially those who honed their specific strains and growing techniques underground. For them," he writes, "marijuana is more than a product, and it's hard to accept that their labor of love could be commoditized, homogenized, and sold without the personal grower-to-user relationship many marijuana stores in Colorado strive to maintain." Now, it's hard to read that, I must acknowledge, with a straight face. Here you're talking about the romanticization of marijuana right down to the fact that they claim to have an intimate relationship between the marijuana grower and the retailer and the user. One man who acknowledges the coming transformation is Derek Peterson of TerraTech, identified as a California-based company that makes hydroponic greenhouse equipment for both traditional and marijuana growers and is opening medical marijuana facilities in Nevada. He said this, and I quote, "We're a mass-produced society, from the food we eat to the television we watch. Ultimately," he said, "big alcohol or big tobacco is going to come into this space. I can't imagine that it won't happen," end quote. Nor, I think, can any honest person. We simply can't imagine that it won't happen. And as we look at it, even if marijuana growers, surprisingly enough, are surprised, even if through their smoky haze, they're having a hard time imagining the threat coming from big tobacco as big marijuana, it's Christians operating out of a biblical worldview who understand that a little bit of sin never stays a little bit. Little sins become big sins, and little sin industries become big sin industries, big in every conceivable way. The parable is clear, and the shock is this, that anyone could be shocked. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmoeller. Remember, we're taking questions for Ask Anything Weekend Edition. Call with your question and your voice to 877-505-2058. That's 877-505-2058. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to spts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.